Hello, everybody. A week ago today, actually, I just got back from Florida, where I had been on vacation with my wife and my older granddaughter. And we saw a lot of alligators. And my granddaughter had this fear that they were after her. And it got me thinking about, all the concerns that all of us have. And it's part of the human condition. For example, should I go out on a date with George or tell him I'm ill? Is it okay if I take money out of my mom's purse to buy ice cream? And some of these concerns are really serious, and others are just ordinary things, like should I eat ice cream or not? But what about should I go to college, get in big debt? Big one. Now, some of you are old enough to worry about your parents. Now, they're getting old. What am I going to do about them? My dad doesn't quite think as well as he used to. So they're big concerns and little concerns. And Henry David Thoreau, the famous Walton Pond guy, said once, most people live lives of quiet desperation and go to their graves that way. Quiet desperation. And just little things like, did I leave the dog in the backyard when I came this morning? Or something big. So what's Buddhism have to say about some of this? What I'm going to say today is pretty basic, because we have a lot of people who are here for the first time or the second time. They're wondering, well, how should I practice? I hear all these different things. And, I try to sit and I get sore knees. So what's all that about? And so we want to talk a little bit about how we can practice in a relatively simple way. And you can start today, actually. What I'm talking about, this idea of, all of these perpetual concerns we all have, and it's natural. It's part of the human condition. It really is at the very heart of the Buddhist teaching. The Buddha was really concerned about, the ordinary life of the individual and basically how we can live our lives and basically what are the things that really bother us. When he was 29, probably most of you know Buddha's story. He supposedly lived in a life of luxury. And when he was 29, he had 4 sightings. His parents had tried to protect him from the sorrows of the world, the suffering of the world. And the first sighting, and I'm not sure I have them all in the right order, but the first sighting was a real sick person. And he asked his charioteer, what's wrong with that person? And he said, well, that's a very sick person. And then he had another sighting of a dead person, and on and on. And the last sighting was a seeker, a kind of a holy person who was trying to really understand the human condition and what we can do about it. And that's what many of us are here today about, the human condition. And so he went off, and for 6 years, he tried, as if you know the stories, he tried various kinds of ascetic kinds of practices. He starved himself, supposedly eating 1 grain of rice a day, things like this. And finally, he had a great awakening. And his first great talk after his awakening, he talked about what's called the 4 great truths. And the very first of the 4 great truths was the universality of this quiet desperation, something that oftentimes in Buddhism we call suffering. To me, suffering just seems kind of extreme because of but just these daily concerns, and we're not satisfied, there are problems, etc., etc. And so his first great revelation, basically, was the universality of that condition in, let's say, unenlightened people. His second great understanding was the cause of that concern. And oftentimes we say the cause is something like attachment or wanting. And you don't want things to change because you like it the way it is. You may feel you're young and I'm getting older and I don't like it. You know, somebody told me that one time. I don't like it. I'm getting older. Or you like your job and you're afraid you're going to lose it. But also there's something more broad that we call the three poisons that I think contribute to, you know, these kinds of uncomfortable feelings. The first certainly is attachment or wanting and not wanting things to change. But the second is dislike, anger, hatred. You don't like things. That's a poison. It poisons the way we interact with the world. And then the third poison is delusion, and that is not seeing the world as it is, or at least as clearly as we could see it, if you will. And so basically those those three poisons really produce a lot of our unease, if you will. The third of his great revelations and understandings was that situation can change. And what you do is you learn to control those poisons. You watch them arise. You learn to do something with them, etc. And then the fourth, sometimes these are called noble truths, was the so-called Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path is divided into three parts. And one part is right understanding or wisdom. A second part is morality or ethics. And a third part is really developing awareness, concentration, mindfulness. And oftentimes, the three trainings are compared to a three-legged stool. Obviously, if you don't have all three legs, the stool falls over. And so we have right understanding, morality, and right mindfulness, if you will. So the Buddha was very concerned, basically. And he said, basically, when they asked him, what do you teach? He says, all I teach is suffering and release from suffering. And over the several thousand years, 2,500 years since the Buddha's death, basically, parts of Buddhism had become elaborated. You know, there were monasteries and complex sutras and doctrines, etc. But at the very heart of the Buddha's own teaching, basically, was just that. The recognition first of what we might call suffering or dis-ease. And second, that there is a release from it. A lot of times we have a very romanticized a view of what what Zen is or what Buddhism might be. We think of wizards in robes transforming our minds, you know, all kinds of fancy things. And when I first became exposed to Buddhism, it was by reading that great master, Jack Koryak. And maybe you don't know Jack Koryak. But he wrote books like On the Road, The Dharma Bombs, and he had a great time with his buddies, whipping across the United States in a car, drinking beer and raising hell. And I figured, if that's Buddhism, I can do it. I can do it. And of course, that's not quite what Buddhism is. But it got me going on the path. And then a second turn I took, again, off the wrong direction, up a dark alley, there was a guy in the late 40s, early 50s called John Blofield, who was one of the very first Westerners to actually go to China and do research and write books. And he wrote a famous book on transforming the mind that came out in 1955. And I read that, and I said, I can transform my mind. You know, I'm going to be completely different. And I don't know what I had in mind. Maybe I could fly or something like that. So we have a lot of romanticized or uncertain or at least unexamined views about what Buddhism and Zen is. Why are we here? You know, what's that uncomfortable feeling? Is it? Whatever. And most basically, when we work our way through all of that, we come back to the Buddha's basic teaching, that it's not transforming the mind in some wild sense. drinking beer, maybe that's part of it, but it's not exactly that. And so I wanted to talk a little bit today about a practice that really is centered around and focused upon some of the Buddha's early teaching. And of course, if you look at the Eightfold Path, there are things like, right action, right speech. And that doesn't tell you a lot. You know, what's right speech mean? And what they mean by the word right, by the way, is just that it's not right in some ordained sense, but if you follow this path, it leads to a better understanding of the causes of suffering, which are really basically part of the third noble truth. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the precepts, because the precepts are a way of working with things like right speech, right understanding, right action, etc., in a more specific way. And in fact, if you want, once a year, usually we have a little class with a ceremony in which you work to take 16 of these precepts. And that's what you get, one of these little things, a rakusu. And it doesn't mean necessarily that I am a Buddhist or anything like that. What it means basically is that I am going to try to live my life by following these precepts. And they have ideas like don't do harm. In Buddhism, if there's one principle that summarizes Buddhist teaching, is don't do harm. If you can get that far, then you can start working on doing good and things like this. And so you might watch, there's a ceremony called the Jukai ceremony where one basically souls one of these things and decides to live to a life of the precepts. Well, I'm going to just mention, go through quickly, five mindfulness precepts, and they are on the front of your bulletin if you want to follow them. And the first one is, I resolve to protect the lives of human beings, animals, and plants. In old India, where everything was negative, it just said, don't kill. Don't kill. But here we say, I resolve to protect the lives of human beings, animals, and plants. And Thich Nhat Hanh, one of the great living Buddhist teachers today, he elaborates on that in a little book called The Heart of the Buddhist Teaching, if anyone's interested in a real introductory book that's nice to read and understandable, etc. And he says about this first precept, aware of the suffering caused by the destruction of life, I am committed to cultivating compassion and learning ways to protect the lives of people, animals, plants, and minerals. I am determined not to kill, not to let others kill, and not to support any act of killing in the world, in my thinking, and in my way of life. So besides the idea of not killing, there's also in here the idea of doing our best to protect all life. And when we hear this first, we say, well, there are a lot of complexities. We can all probably think of situations where you might end up killing. Now, what about eating meat? Isn't a plant alive? And what are you left to eat but rocks and things like that? Or let's say you're in some dangerous part of the world and your family is being attacked, and the only way you can survive is by shooting and maybe killing another person who's trying to kill your family. There's all kinds of complexities in all of these things. And so part of sitting with the precepts is to understand them and think of plans and ways of acting. If you were a Buddhist child, you actually grew up with hundreds of stories that gave you little insights into how to be compassionate, how not to kill, how to interact with others. And some of these are called Jataka stories, and they're about the early lives of the Buddhas. The Buddha went through all kinds of lives. He was an animal at various times, a plant, all kinds of human beings, lowly, high, on and on. And if you're a little child in an Asian Buddhist country, you grew up listening to these stories. And just two, for example. One's called the Banyan Deer. And these are all classic stories. And by the way, you can get on the web and you can buy modern Buddhist stories for kids. But this is a classic one. And one time in one of his lives, the Buddha was a deer. And he was part of a vast herd on a king's hunting preserve. So the thing was enclosed and you couldn't get out. And every few days, the king would send his hunter in to kill a deer so that they could eat the meat. And of course, every time the deer saw the hunter coming, everyone was in a panic, and everyone fled. And so they decided, well, there's got to be a better way to react to this. Obviously, the king's going to get his meat, but why not have a lottery? And then we'll just decide whose turn it is, so that when the hunter comes, the deer presents himself to the hunter. And that way, the other people don't have to go into this big panic. Okay? Well, one day, a young doe who was pregnant was chosen through the lottery. And the Buddha, the Banyan deer, said, she said, it's my turn, I'm going to go. And he said, you know, I will take your place. And obviously this is a story about compassion. And so when the king heard that this magnificent deer, the Banyan deer, had given himself instead, he felt so compassionate himself that he refused to hunt deer anymore. And it's one of those good Phil stories, if you will. So here's a story about being compassionate. There's another one about the effects of greed. And this story comes in several different ways. The one I usually use is there's a pesky monkey in a village, and some of you have heard this story before. And you know, if you leave your window open, the monkey jumps in your room and steals rings and food and things like this. And the villagers are running around with a net trying to catch the monkey. And a monk comes along and says, "What are you doing?" And they're saying, "We're trying to catch that pesky monkey." The monk says, "Bring me a jar with a narrow top and some peanuts." And they do that, and he puts the peanuts in. The monkey puts his hands in to get the peanuts. Of course, in doing so, he forms a fist, and he's caught. And to release himself, all he has to do is let go of the peanuts. You know what I mean? But he can't. And this is many of our greed and our attachment. A version of that story, by the way, has to do with a coconut, where you cut the top of a coconut off. I mean, there's still a little hole. You force a banana in there. And he reaches and grabs the banana and, of course, can get his hand out, if you will. So there are a lot of stories like this that if, you know, we're training someone to be a Buddhist, that help us understand these precepts. So here's the second of the precepts. I resolve to prevent the exploitation of humans by humans of other living beings in nature. And again, the old way, it's just don't steal. Thich Nhat Hanh phrases it this way: aware of the suffering caused by exploitation, social injustice, stealing, and oppression, I am committed to cultivating loving kindness and learning ways to work for the well-being of people, animals, plants, and minerals. I will practice generosity by sharing my time, energy, and material resources with those who are in real need. I am determined not to steal and not to possess anything that should belong to others. I will respect the property of others, and I will prevent others from profiting from human suffering or the suffering of other species on earth. And again, if you read that and mull over it and think about it and sit with it, you can see the depth and complexity, basically, of that kind of precept, particularly as a guide to living your life. Now, here's the third one. I resolve to protect children and adults from sexual abuse and to preserve the happiness of individuals and families. Thich Nhat Hanh says, aware of the suffering caused by sexual misconduct, I am committed to cultivating responsibility and learning ways to protect the safety and integrity of individuals, couples, families, and society. I am determined not to engage in sexual relations without love and a long-term commitment. To preserve the happiness of myself and others, I am determined to respect my commitments and the commitments of others. I will do everything in my power to protect children from sexual abuse and to prevent couples and families from being broken up by sexual misconduct. And most basically, Most basically, this precept is about protecting relationships, if you will, our own and others. Even things like flirting, and it's fun to flirt, right? But you flirt with somebody who takes you seriously and thinks there may be a relationship, and of course, you're just flirting. You know, things like that that are subtle, etc., and can be very, very harmful to people. And of course, we're all aware of the widespread sexual abuse in the world. The fourth is I resolve to practice deep listening and loving speech. Thich Nhat Hanh says, aware of the suffering caused by unmindful speech and the inability to listen to others, I am committed to cultivating loving speech and deep listening in order to bring joy and happiness to others and relieve others of their suffering. Knowing that words can create happiness or suffering, I am determined to speak truthfully with words that inspire self-confidence, joy, and hope. I will not spread news that I do not know to be certain and will not criticize or condemn things of which I am not sure. I will refrain from uttering words that can cause division or discord or that can cause the family or the community to break. I am determined to make all efforts to reconcile and resolve all conflicts, however small. One of the greatest gifts we can give another is the gift of listening. And I'm sure you've all heard the old adage about what's a conversation. You know, we say this all the time around here. What's a conversation? It's one person talking and the other person waiting to talk. Waiting to talk. So obviously you're not listening. You're not listening with great kindness. A lot of times, people don't want you to respond. People don't want advice. One of the great gifts of learning to be a good listener is not to give uninvited advice, but just to listen. I had a brother-in-law who died a few years ago of Lou Gehrig's disease. And all he wanted to do was just have a person sit with him that he could talk to about his life. You know, he didn't want me to say, oh, poor guy, I hope things will get better. You know, he knew that wasn't going to happen. He just wanted someone to listen. And there are little skills that we can use to help us become really mindful listening. And one I just ran across not long ago is called the three-question rule. And so you have a conversation with somebody, and they start telling you about something they did. And, of course, you want to jump in and say, yeah, I just got back from Florida. Let me tell you about the Gators. They were 9 feet long, you know. Well, the three-question rule says is before you talk about yourself, you ask that person three questions about themselves. It's a wise rule. It's a wonderful rule. And, of course, by the time you get to a third question, the question has deepened. The person's opened up. You know what I mean? And so it's just kind of a wonderful rule. But like all precepts, again, this one, you know, how do you, you know, can you stick to it 100%? And I'm retired now, but when I was working, I was an anthropologist. One of the great books I read was something called The Prevalence of Deceit. The Prevalence of Deceit. And the whole point of the book was that societies can't hold together unless we tell little white lies. You know, and so your significant other gets up in the morning looking dreadful. He's like, lovely, lovely. and so we have to remember that, you know, there's a line there. And again, by sitting with it. And I think most of us in 99.9% of the time, we have kind of a basic common sense when we know, for example, that we're listening, that we're being compassionate, that we're being kind. We know, we have a feel for it, right? We just have to listen to ourselves and hear that voice, if you will. Okay, the last of the precepts is I resolve to practice mindful consumption. And consumption, of course, in the old days it was don't drink alcohol, but consumption can be all kinds of things. So here's Thich Nhat Hanh. Aware of the suffering caused by unmindful consumption, I am committed to cultivating good health, both physical and mental, for myself, my family, and my society by practicing mindful eating, drinking, and consuming. I will ingest only items that preserve peace, well-being, and joy in my body, in my consciousness, and in the collective body and consciousness of my family and society. I am determined not to abuse alcohol or any other intoxicant, or to ingest foods or other items that contain toxins, such as certain TV programs, magazines, books, films, and conversations. I understand that a proper diet, both a physical and mental diet, is crucial for self-transformation and for the transformation of society. When we were in London, when we were in Florida, we also lived in London. But when we were in Florida, and we had two big bedrooms, and then we had a little room that maybe was from about here over here that was living room, dining room, and kitchen. And up in the wall was a TV. And my 16-year-old granddaughter used to watch Bad Girls. Now, I don't know if anybody, does anyone around here watch Bad Girls? It's one of those cable things. Bad girls. These are bad girls. Let me tell you. And so if I was going to sit any place but the bedroom, of course I had to sit and listen to Bad Girls, you know. And so one day I said to my granddaughter, you know, I'm not going to tell you what to watch, you know, but your mother's not here. And at least I have to say that this is pretty trashy. And she says, yeah, well, it's fun. So the idea on this precept is not just you can cloud your mind in all kinds of ways, if you will. So those are the five basic precepts. But the question is, how do you practice them? How do you practice them? You know, you can read them, but, you know, how do I live my life according to the precepts? And this is right understanding. When we read the Eightfold Path, again, we tend to want to mystify, you know, some of these things. You know, right knowledge, right understanding, right action, etc. And a lot of it, like right understanding, is just understanding how to get rid of bad habits and develop new ones. That's right understanding. Okay, it doesn't mean you have to know the sutras in great detail. You just have to have good, solid advice about how to lead a compassionate, wholesome life, if you will. So this is one leg of the three-legged stool. And again, the Buddha started to point out how basically we can live with the precepts. And in the very first verses of a book called the Dhammapada, which is really a recorded sayings of the Buddha, and he's giving you advice. So this is the very opening verse that sets the tone for everything else. He says, "All that we are is a result of what we have thought. We are formed and molded by our thoughts. Those whose minds are shaped by selfish thoughts cause misery when they speak or act. Sorrows roll over them as the wheels of a cart roll over the tracks of the bullock that draws it." All that we are is the result of what we have thought. We are formed and molded by our thoughts. Those whose minds are shaped by selfless thoughts give joy whenever they speak or act. Joy follows them like a shadow that never leaves them. So the Buddha is pointing basically to our mind. In a lot of our training in Buddhism, basically is mind training. Now there's a lot of Buddhist and Zen rhetoric that gets in the way when you first start. They say, no effort, don't try, don't do this, you're perfect just the way you are. You know, things like this. And you know, it's very confusing. When you first start, you have to make some effort. And you have to try and you have to understand, basically, that a lot of this is mind training. And what we're trying to do is to change the habits, our ways, basically, of thinking. And our mind can just change from one second to another in the way we understand things. And so here's another story, basically, from a Buddhist tradition. And that is, somebody was out in a boat, a swiftly flowing river. They're fishing, you know, trying to stabilize the boat. And they look up the river, and they see another boat floating down the river towards them. And they think nothing of it. And a little later they look and it's getting even closer and it's coming right at them. And then they look again and it's going to hit them for sure. And so the person in the boat yells out, "You fool, you fool, you know, get out of the way, you're going to hit my boat, you know, you dummy." And of course, when the boat crashes into yours, you look inside and there's nobody there. There's nobody there. The boat just became loose in its moorings and drifted down the river. And in that instant, basically your entire mood changes, etc. One from being angry and upset to just realizing fate. A more recent story, and one I gave at the Loving Kindness retreat we had a month ago or so, so excuse me for repeating it, but I like the story. You're driving around a parking lot in front of a grocery store, a big store, Whole Foods or something, and I've done that many times, you know, and you can't find a parking place. And suddenly you see somebody looks like they're pulling out. So you pull up like we all know to do. You put your blinker on, you know, you wait for the person to back out, and just as you're ready to go into the slot, of course, we know it's coming. This little Jeep comes shooting along, jumps right into the slot, etc. You beep angrily, right? The person gets out and gives you a very rude gesture. And I'll let your mind think of all those gestures, etc. So you're mad for days, okay? Same thing happens, another situation, that you have your blinker on, the person pulls out, you're getting ready to go in, and you go to pull in, and a cow walks into the middle of the slot and looks at you with those big cow eyes and goes, "Moo." What do? You go, "Look, a cow." "My heavens, a cow. Wow, that's great, a cow." Basically, here are two situations. You've lost your spot both times, but you react to it in quite different ways. And in fact, that last saying is the title of a book on anger management. It's called The Cow in the Parking Place. And you can look it up. It's a wonderful, wonderful book. If you will. So the idea, of course, is that a lot of our reactions basically are just our perceptions of a situation. And so we want to understand why we act in the way we do. And there's been just a huge amount of study, some of it actually motivated by the Buddhist quest for happiness that has to do with the way habits form in the brain. And this is neurophysiology. What's a happy brain look like? There still is a famous neurophysiologist at the University of Wisconsin called Richie Davidson. And back in the 80s, when he was a graduate student, he wanted to study happiness. And people said, "You know, you're a doctor. You know, you don't study happiness. You study illness." Right? Illness. And so he couldn't get a grant. His advisor said, "You can't write your dissertation on happiness. I never heard of such a thing." So when he became a professional, he started to take a little bit of money from his grants and start studying the neural. And if you know something about this, you can actually see all the waves, etc., the waves of happy people. He connected up with the Dalai Lama, who sent him really advanced. I don't know if you know about the 10,000-hour rule, the idea that you have to do something 10,000 hours before you become a professional, whether it's swatting the microphone, the tennis racket 10,000 times, but, people who had meditated 10,000 times, etc. And thus they learned a lot, basically, about the difference between an unhealthy brain and a happy brain. And basically what happens what happens when we act is the synapses, all this talk about brains, the synapses, etc., fire together to form a habit. It's to our evolutionary benefit, basically, to develop habits. Because if every time the lion jumped out from behind the bush, we had to think of how to react freshly every time, etc., we'd probably be eaten up and have no ancestors. So there are reasons why we basically produce habits in the brain. But some of these habits can be harmful habits and quite bad habits. And the way we interact with people in speech. And we enter a group, and right away we want to force our view on them. We want to tell somebody we're talking to about our vacation and things like this. And so we basically can have bad habits. What we find basically is that the longer people react in habitual ways, I use the term grooves, the deeper the grooves become. So that if something arises, you act automatically because it's a habit. And what this says basically, if you're going to develop new habits, like we're all going to start today, to work with the precepts, etc., that basically you have to build new grooves. You have to get the synapses to fire together so they can wire together. And we know that's how it works. And it's very, very difficult and hard. You don't just say, I'm going to start to be gracious. I'm going to start to be a gracious talker and things like this. You have to have a plan. You have to actually really approach it in a systematic way, etc. And so we have all of these grooves. How do we work with what arises? We have some kind of stimulation. Usually we react to a stimulation that's positive, it's negative, or it's neutral. And then we have a habit, basically, a habitual way of reacting to that positive, negative, or neutral kind of stimulus, if you will. And then we have to decide, I'm going to do it. You know, I'm going to do this action, etc. Well, if you've been around for a while, what you recognize is the five skandhas, etc., form, sensation, perception, formation, and consciousness, etc. And this is one way to actually work with it. So basically what we do, one reason we sit on the mat is to develop the ability to concentrate so we can focus our mind, and we develop the ability to be aware of what arises, etc. And so we sit there and we become sensitive basically to watching these emotions like anger or joy or fear or sadness or envy or whatever it might be basically arise. And let me give you a more practical example of how this might work. Is that you've been asked by your boss to come up with a plan for something at work, whatever it might be. And so there's a meeting and everyone's sitting there and you give your brilliant plan. And somebody says, that's just the worst, silliest thing I've ever heard. Okay. So here's that stimulus. That's the worst, silliest thing I've ever heard, right? That's coming at you. And how do you react? It's negative, positive, or neutral. This stuff is really negative. And in the perception part of it, you say, I have been dished. This person's really after me. So then you have to decide, well, how am I going to react? Am I going to tell this person off? But maybe the person is a little higher than me in the company, so I have to swallow it. I'm going to die of ulcers or something like that. And finally, you decide how to act. Okay? And this in Tibetan Buddhism is something I learned from my Tibetan teacher, is a way to act so that we sit there and we develop our ability to firmly watch what's arising. That's concentration, that's mindfulness, etc. And then you watch this reaction coming up. It's negative. And you watch yourself with this habitual action about striking back. And through this practice, you give yourself some room. To watch what you're doing and then to act differently in a wiser, more thought-out way, if you will. So that's basically how we go about all of this. Now, who's doing the watching? And this is something has various names. Sometimes it's called the observer. Oftentimes it's called the witness. And if you actually sit on your mat and you sit and you watch thoughts arise, you realize that you are watching your thoughts, right? You are not your thoughts. Thoughts are part of you, of course. And just like an arm is a part of you, but your arm is not you, all of you, etc. And so one of the most powerful attainments, if I can use that word in Buddhism, is to learn to work with the witness. To work with a witness that you can observe and give yourself a little bit of space in there, so that you don't just react quickly without thinking. There's another practice I'm going to mention, and a lot of times, of course, you react stupidly anyway. You know better, but you do it anyway. And that's just part of being human. And there's a whole practice called bowing. Bowing at stupidity. And I love it. I came across an article in the Tricycle magazine. And you do something, and instead of saying, "Oh, guy, there you did it again. You know, I've been at this for so many years, and I'm still saying stupid things," you know, or whatever it might be. And instead of getting angry at yourself, you either give a real one or an inside, a silent bow. And you just say, "That's being human. That's being human. I'm going to try again." And it's a wonderful practice, just bowing to what arises. You know that basically you're going to mess up. And so don't get mad at yourself. Also, and I'm nearing the end of this a little bit here, there's also a lot of information on habit formation. And there's a wonderful book that just came out called The Power of Habit. And it tells you basically how to form new habits. But a lot of the book has to do with big companies like Target and how they try to get you to form new habits. And anyway, so that's another topic, but it's fascinating. But basically, there's a three-part. There's a cue, there's the routine, there's a reward. And so let's say you're going to get in shape. And so the cue, you leave your running shoes near the door. You see them, I got to run. And when I was getting a haircut last time, I was looking at a men's magazine, and here was a little article on this, and there were three pictures. And in the first picture, there's this guy running like this, and there's a big bubble, and in the bubble, there's a picture of a stein of beer. And that's his reward. The next picture, the three pictures, the same thing. There he is, running along, stein of beer. And, of course, the third picture, there he is, and what he sees himself, instead of a stein of beer, he sees himself running. He's fit. That's the endorphins. And so the point of a lot of that training is that you're more systematic when you start to form a new habit and break an old one. And then over time, as you work on it, it becomes a regular part of your habit, of your routine, etc. When I was going to the gym and feeling really lazy and I didn't want to work hard in the treadmill, etc. When I was done, I'd go over to Lund's and get myself a power bar. but there are other kind of rewards. My wife, when I mention physical rewards like that, kind of laughs and says, "Well, you shouldn't need a reward." So another way to do it is journaling. And it contains the cue and the reward. And when you get up in the morning, you say, "Today I'm going to try to do this. I'm going to talk with two people this morning. And I'm going to use the three-question rule and see what happens." That's it. That's it. One thing you learn in habit formation is start small. Start small. And not big things, just one thing or two every day and kind of work on them, if you will. And that's the way basically it goes. And at night, basically you write in your little journal about what happened, good or bad. And when you journal like this, you never journal for more than a minute or two. I mean, nothing long, just real short. "Today I'm going to do this." And at the end of the day, you do that. And journaling is just a wonderful, wonderful way to give yourself a cue and a reward and to set your intention. And again, I'm saying that if you're going to follow the precepts, you say, "Today I'm just going to work with a consumption precept. And this evening after, when I watch TV or whatever it is, I'm going to be alert to see what kind of, you know, toxins I'm bringing, you know, something like that." So I think you get the picture. Okay, well, let's end with a little thing about what are we doing and what's our goal. And I said earlier on, we're not transforming our mind to become a wizard or something like that. So what is our goal? And what are we trying to do here in some broader sense? And here's a koan. A koan's a little saying, an exchange between usually a master and a student. And this is called "Everyday Mind is the Way." And this koan is about an encounter between Nanchan and the student Xiao Shou. Xiao Shou asked Nanchan, "What is the way?" And what he's asking is, how shall I live? You know, what's the truth? So what is the way? Nanchan said, "Everyday mind is the way." Xiao Shou said, "Should I turn toward it or not?" Nanchan said, "If you turn toward it, you turn away from it." Xiao Shou asked, "How can I know the way if I don't turn toward it? In other words, how can I practice?" And Nanchan says, the way is not about knowing or not knowing. It goes on and on. And the whole point of this koan, and we have a koan course May and June, basically is what the way is about is just ordinary mind. Just ordinary mind. That's the way. Ordinary mind. And of course, you can when people say, well, I've got to... I'm perfect just the way I am. Ordinary mind and ordinary mind are really two different things. There's ordinary mind and there's ordinary mind. And of course, and that's always the paradox I love about Zen. You know what I mean? Of course, we don't want this ordinary mind to be the way, but rather you're going to take the precepts and you're going to work with them so that you can see life around you more clearly, more clearly. You don't change. You're not transformed. It's not that bad things don't happen. It's just that you see them in a different way. Okay? So that one person says, this is the silliest thing I've ever heard, etc. You know how to respond in a way that doesn't cause you suffering and cause suffering among other people around you. So again, ordinary mind is the way. And that's what we're trying to do. Just have a practice, etc., a simple practice, etc., in which we're able to live our normal, everyday life in a more insightful way. And basically, that's what awakening is. When people talk about awakening in Buddhism, you know, somehow you think celestial stars, you know what I mean, transcendence, Orlando and Disney World, I don't know. But what it is, awakening, is just being the way you are in a more awake way. And I think that's it. Yeah. Any comments or quick words?
I'd like to make a comment. I think it was a very satisfying Dharma talk. And I also think you're a very interesting guy. Part of fun.
No interesting. Okay, I'm sorry I talked a little longer, but that shows what happens when you go on vacation and come back and you're just off speed. Okay.